Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 3, 2006. This is Doug Henwood. Looking as we do most weeks at this time with the worlds of economics and politics, I've got three guests for tonight. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Harold Meyerson, who is a contributor, I think his title is editor-at-large, perhaps, at the American Prospect, about a piece he wrote in that magazine about Change to Win, the coalition of unions that broke away from the AFL-CIO about a year ago. He has a piece offering a rather critical look at that that experiment, and we'll ask him to talk about that. Then, about 20, 25 minutes after the hour, we'll listen to an interview I recorded earlier today with Judith Kipper, who is a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and one of their Middle East specialists. We'll get a very establishment, liberal view of what's going on in the Lebanon, Israel's aggressive actions, Israel on the warpath. She will explain to us why Israel is America's good friend from a sort of establishmentarian point of view. And then a little after the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Jonathan Knitson, who is an economist at York University, who has written extensively with his collaborator Shimshon Bishler about the Israeli economy, some of the economic underpinnings of war in the Middle East, economic underpinnings in the United States. That is, when oil profits dip, there seems to be a Middle Eastern war. And we'll ask Jonathan Knitson to talk about that. Also, something about the structure of Israeli capitalism, Israeli political economy. There was a piece in the Financial Times the other day saying that Israel can easily afford this war. Well, ask Jonathan if he thinks that's true, but also what it might be that drives this state of perpetual war that Israel finds itself in. And not much in the way of economic headlines today, just more of the same, really. Consumer attitudes still sort of middling. The job market also kind of middling. Tomorrow morning we'll get from the Bureau of Labor Statistics the monthly employment report. This will give us the number of jobs gained or lost, and almost certainly gained, but probably not all that many in the month of July. What happened with the unemployment rate? What's happening with earnings? Looking for a pretty weak report. The labor market is certainly not falling apart. The U.S. economy is certainly not falling apart, but it does seem to be slowing down. And that's really not much of a surprise after, 15, 16 consecutive interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve and oil prices close to $75 a barrel. So when you have a spike in interest rates and a spike in oil prices, the economy generally slows down and sometimes enters recession. Also, the housing market continues to give evidence of really losing, the housing bubble giving serious evidence of losing serious air now. So it looks to be a rather a dramatic contraction in the housing market. Since the expansion in housing has been the principal driving force for the U.S. economy, or a principal driving force of the U.S. economy over the last 3 or 4 years, losing that motor could have interesting effects. It's not only that people felt richer because the value of their houses were rising, they're also borrowing against the value of the houses and spending it on widescreen TVs and porch furniture and all kinds of things like that. But also an unusually direct contribution from the building of new housing, which has been stimulating the economy over the last several years. So losing all those stimuli all at once, at the same time oil prices are rising and interest rates have risen, and interest rates have been pushed up by the Federal Reserve over the last year and a half. This could be an interesting package, so we shall see what happens in the coming weeks and months, but I don't think we're going to see any kind of acceleration in the economy. It looks like the best days of this expansion are behind us. So what comes next is the big question. What comes next right now is a little musical break while we get Harold Meyerson on the phone.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies.
And I don't get fooled by the factory rules, 'cause I always read between the lines, and I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say,
a song from, oh, about 30 years ago, The Straubs, Part of the Union, a memorial of the time when unions were very, very strong, almighty, and at least in Great Britain could bring down governments. But then Margaret Thatcher brought them down a few years after that song came out. Now we're joined on the line by Harold Meyerson, who is a editor at large, I believe is your title, Harold?
I'm at large generally, yes.
Okay, for the American Prospect, and has a piece in the current issue, which is, I guess, the July-August issue of that magazine, called Hard Labor, a rather critical look of change to win, the group of unions that broke away from the AFL-CIO about a year ago. So, first of all, just the basics. Who are the unions that broke away and why?
Right. The unions that broke away include some of the three of the four unions that were in the AFL-CIO that had more than a million members apiece, those being the Service Employees International Union, the Teamsters, and the United Food and Commercial Workers, which is mainly supermarket and packing house workers. Also, Unite Here, which is a merger of the hotel workers and what was left of the unionized clothing, garment, and textile workers in the United States. Two construction unions, the laborers and the carpenters, which were already out of the AFL-CIO, the carpenters were. And then a small but celebrated union with a very celebrated past, the United Farm Workers. These are unions which, at first glance and even second glance, don't necessarily have a lot in common with one another. SEIU and Unite Here, I think people would put among the most politically progressive of American unions and two of the most either successful or not unsuccessful unions that actually continuing to organize new members at a time when that gets harder and harder. Some of the other unions, the Teamsters and the Carpenters in particular, have over the last several decades not been known as among the more progressive unions, and most of the rest of these unions have, like the rest of American unions generally, had a lot of trouble organizing new workers, and some of them haven't really therefore engaged in that much over the last several decades either, though some have.
And when they started Change to Win, it was done with some fanfare and some fairly high expectations. Now, about a year later, how's it looking?
Well, I think it's fair to say that good work is going on, but it's at the retail level, not the wholesale level, and it was at the wholesale level that the promises were made and the premises of the organization were laid out. The unions, there were any number of rhetorical and real reasons, some of which overlapped, some of which didn't, for these unions leaving the AFL-CIO. Some of it was almost personal, too. I mean, these were unions that thought that they did think that the AFL-CIO was more or less becalmed and that the labor movement needed a jump start. There's no question about that. It's not clear, though, that Change to Win itself has really been able to do that jump start. And the sorts of things they were saying was, we're going to reinvent organizing on a large scale. And that in particular is and was the mantra of Tom Woodruff, who was one of the four vice presidents of SEIU, kind of a master organizer in a period in history when there aren't too many people who can legitimately claim that title, and the director of strategic organizing for the new federation, for Change to Win. And Tom was talking at the time of Change to Win's founding convention last September in St. Louis about, you know, it wasn't enough to organize what are called in labor parlance hot shops, but individual companies. individual facilities. You've got to go for the whole company. You've got to go for the whole sector just to keep up with, among other things, the rate of deunionization that's going on in this country when, you know, GM and Ford each, you know, lay off 30,000 workers apiece, that sort of thing. And so they were looking at big targets in retail. I think it's fair to say that some of the big retail chains are to the current economy what the big industrial companies were when the CIO was founded. John L. Lewis, the founding president of the CIO, said, well, you know, we have to organize General Motors and United States Steel. Well, you look at the economy today and you look at work that can't be relocated to China and India, and you know, quickly come upon Walmart, Home Depot, Target, et cetera. Now, Walmart is more.
That's
even
the big kahuna, and one of the Change to Win affiliates, the UFCW, has been trying to organize them. Now, historically, UFCW has not been known as one of the more dynamic members of the labor movement. How are they doing more recently?
Well, it's what Change to Win quickly found out is that its member unions, UFCW among them, weren't really up to these world-defying challenges that Tom Woodruff had laid out. And so much of the work of the new organization has been to speed the development of organizing capacity, which is very complicated and, you know, involves stuff, requiring more than training, requiring a whole reorientation of a union, which is, you know, in a union that big, it's a big deal. That's the work of the new federation, coming up with strategic plans that can enable the Teamsters and the United Food and Commercial Workers, you know, to begin to do that. And Joe Hansen, who is the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers, has embarked on this plan that will, you know, significantly change the union. But this is going to take a long time. So it's not like there is a Walmart campaign ongoing right now. There are public relations campaigns against Walmart, one funded by UFCW and one funded by SEIU, and, you know, at some point fairly soon, I think under the aegis of Change to Win, the two will be combined. But you can't really point to any major organizing there. The one major organizing drive that the United Food and Commercial Workers has going is against Smithfield, a meat processing plant in North Carolina. It's a huge plant, but it's exactly what Tom Woodruff was saying. They wanted to get beyond one factory organizing at a time. They want to get beyond it, but, you know, the problem is that's where they are. And more broadly, the act of leaving the AFL-CIO didn't magically change the organizing capacities of the UFCW or the Teamsters, and it certainly didn't magically change the very hostile climate that exists as a result of the general worldview of American businesses and some other reasons, too, that unions confront.
Well, is anybody in the American labor movement up to the task of organizing Walmart?
Right now, no, or it would be ongoing. It's massive. No. I mean, you could, you know, sketch a scenario whereby in X number of years someone might be up to it. But I think that scenario would have to include a change in the legal climate. I mean, you would have to envision the Democrats controlling both Congress and the White House passing the Employee Free Choice Act, which is a bill that has languished there since the Republicans will not, you know, bring it to the floor, which essentially decriminalizes the act of joining a union. Right now, you can join a union. You know, you can be fired, but the penalties against, which is illegal, but the penalties against the company for firing you are negligible. This would permit workers to join unions the way they do in Canada, which is if a majority of workers sign cards, the union is recognized. It would require the company to actually reach a contract with the union then within a year. Short of that kind of change, given the power of Walmart in the larger world, and I would strongly recommend a piece on Walmart by a writer named Barry Lynn in the current issue of Harper's, which is just a brilliant piece on Walmart's relation to the real economy. I think it's going to be, you know, just impossible and almost imponderable as to how you would organize Walmart.
I'm speaking with Harold Morrison, who is an editor-at-large with The American Prospect and author of a piece in the current issue of the magazine called Hard Labor about Change to Win. As you point out, excuse me, As you point out in the article, the organizing drives that Change to Win features on its website all predate the creation of Change to Win. So they're really not haven't really started up anything new in their youth, have they?
They haven't. I will say that I think they are beginning to move the ball on one of the existing ones in a really interesting way, and that is the Teamsters' efforts to organize truck drivers at America's harbors. With the deregulation of trucking, that industry kind of degenerated into a bunch of super exploited mom and pops. The truck drivers were relabeled independent contractors. Many of them, particularly at the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach, which I know best, the largest port in the United States, clear about $25,000 a year working ridiculous hours with no benefits. I think some very smart strategists on loan from some of the better unions to Change to Win have come up with finally a strategy which could work for organizing truck drivers at the port, which involves political leverage over port commissions and harbor commissions and city councils and the entities where these harbors exist, and then getting them to sort of change the security criteria, which would require real employers, and it goes from there. So what Change to Win is, on the positive side, is some very smart people coming up with some strategies. It's not, these aren't, you know, it'll take a while to get this stuff in place. And one of the ironies here, I might add, is that Change to Win argued that the AFL-CIO's reliance on politics was a bit of a false promise that you know, overinvested in politics and
which means contributing big money to the Democrats phone banks
now,
get out of vote.
It just turns out that the solution in the process of being crafted for how do you organize truck drivers at harbors around America involves the use by these unions of their political power. It was something that SEIU, for instance, has used brilliantly in order to create an employer, again, an industry in which it was no designated employer, per se, for home care workers around the country, of which SEIU has signed up close to 400,000 in the last 7 or 8 years. So they use politics, too. I mean, sometimes it's done in a very strategic way to achieve organizing goals, but, I mean, I always thought some of the choice between politics and organizing was a false choice, and both, you know, good unions on both sides of the fence do both in order to, you know, help themselves grow and at times for the greater good of humankind, at times not as well. But anyway, I think unions need to do both.
I did some math a couple of months ago and figured that at the current rates of decline, union density will hit zero sometime around 2025 or 2030. So that's not exactly tomorrow, but it's not exactly a comforting piece of news either. There was some worry that by splitting organized labor into two like this, it would actually weaken an already fragmented structure, already fragmented and weak structure. Has that turned out to be the case?
I don't think in organizing it's the case. The main worry all along, I think, has been how would this affect labor's political program. Labor has done a fairly good job ever since John Sweeney took over the AFL-CIO and made Steve Rosenthal the political director there. He's no longer that, but of mobilizing its members at election time, and they, to the extent that the Democrats are alive at all in some places, that's in many ways a result of the improved labor operation. And there was some fears that the labor political get out the vote endeavors would be sundered and all hell would break loose with the split. The special elections that took place last year in California over Arnold Schwarzenegger's four ballot measures, all of which lost, saw, and California's a state where almost half of the union members belong to Change to Win unions, they nonetheless found a way to work together and were very effective in defeating those. Now that's being tested nationally. California, the Los Angeles area in particular, kind of represents your best-case scenario for can these unions work together. We'll see if this happens in other places. I gather there are some negotiations still ongoing this week between the National AFL-CIO and National Change to Win about integrating their lists and this sort of thing, which is something you need to do for successful precinct walking and phone banking, whatever. So we shall see.
Yeah, it seems like this much ballyhooed new organization has created neither inspiration nor disaster.
Well, the difference between this organization and the original CIO is the CIO really emerged out of the AFL-CIO with a different in 1935 with a different ideology and a majorly different modus operandi. They were committed to organizing industrial workers in whole industries, which the AFL had opposed, and they were much more political. When the AFL at that time tried to be, if not exactly apolitical, at least nonpartisan at the height of the New Deal, and rather against the beginning of, you know, the very watered-down version of the American welfare state. The differences between Change to Win and the AFL-CIO today are much less pronounced. They're actually increasingly hard to articulate, in fact, except that you have one group in one place and one group in another. And so they've eschewed any kind of clarion ideological call to rally forces to their side, which is something that, you know, Lewis and Sidney Hillman and the founders of the CIO were able to do. And even their operational differences are not that clear from the AFL. So it's not been a new day, and it's not been a disaster either.
Well, isn't that inspiring? Thanks for joining us, Harold Meyerson.
Anytime you want lack of inspiration, just call us.
Okay, certainly. I've been speaking with Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect magazine and author of the piece Hard Labor in the July-August issue of that magazine about Change to Win. Well, let's take a little musical break, and then we'll be back to listen to Judith Kipper. And that was the first minute or so of the Prelude No. 1 from the Well-Tempered Clavier Book 2 by Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. And let's turn to a very orthodox source for the next interview. This is Judith Kipper, who is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington, D.C. And I thought I'd get a hyper-establishment view of what it means that Israel's on the warpath and U.S.-Israeli relations and that sort of thing. So let's listen to this interview recorded earlier today with Judith Kipper.
Does the Bush administration's reaction to the battle over Lebanon and Gaza represent a departure from the policy of previous administrations towards conflicts involving Israel, or is there a good deal of continuity, do you think?
I think there's continuity, but there is always a degree. I think in the past the United States would have acted to restrain Israel, particularly with so much humanitarian damage and so many people being made refugees, innocent people. But I think the policy has been consistent that the United States has a special relationship with Israel, and we tend to support Israel, but we don't always like everything they do.
Let's talk a bit about that special relationship. What precisely is the U.S. interest in being such an aggressive ally of Israel when much of the rest of the world, including most of Israel's neighbors, are against us?
I don't think that we are an ally of Israel because people are for us or against us. Israel is a Western-style democracy. It is was a pioneering self-made state, so to speak, just like the United States. The support for Israel runs deep within the blood of the body politic of Americans, wherever they are, though Americans, while are while they are very supportive of Israel, deeply attached to Israel, they often are critical of specific policies of Israel.
Well, wouldn't it, in a cold rail politics sense, make some sense for the U.S. to ease up on some of its support of Israel and try to make more friends in the Arab world, first of all, because they have all the oil, but second of all, because there's a tremendous amount of hostility towards us?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that it's a zero-sum game that the United States can certainly maintain its special relationship with the State of Israel and also maintain, as it has for almost seven decades, a special relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We've had a strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia, which has the most oil of any country in the world for almost seven decades. The question really is, what can the United States, as the only party to whom they all turn in seeking peace, reconciliation, mediation, negotiation, what is it that the U.S. could do more effectively that would end some of the conflicts so that there wouldn't this question would not arise about whether U.S. support for Israel is somehow an issue in the conflicts in the region?
Well, what could the U.S. do differently? If you had the ear of power, what would you be advising?
Well, I think President Clinton had the right idea when he devoted a lot of time and effort to solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the core issue in the region, and all of what we're seeing in Lebanon is decades and decades and decades of layers of complications that are a result of the non-settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian problem. For a long time, it couldn't be solved. But now everyone knows what the solution is because attitudes have changed. And while Clinton was committed, he was tactical, not strategic. But there was an agreement negotiated at Taba, a small Egyptian resort, toward the end of the Clinton administration that is basically a peace treaty negotiated by the Israelis and the Palestinians, with just a few details left to be worked out. And this is accepted by the vast, vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians ever since then. Depending on how you measure it, anywhere between 60 and 90% of Israelis and Palestinians support the outlines of the Taba Agreement and want it implemented. So the President of the United States has something to work with, needs to review it, write it on an American piece of paper, and make it clear to the parties that when he leaves office, there is going to be a Palestinian state, that what was negotiated in the past still holds. They can nibble around the edges. They can talk about how and when to implement, but they can't get out of it.
A Palestinian state with full control of its own security and financial relations with the outside world, or one still sort of a protectorate of Israel?
No one is envisaging a protectorate of Israel, but the Palestinians themselves have agreed to a demilitarized Palestinian state, and there will be open borders with Jordan, Israel, and Egypt, and to allow the Palestinian economy to function and the free flow of goods and people. So this is not a state that is going to be militarized or have its own defense forces. It's not going to need it, and it's part of the agreement to make sure that the conflict is over permanently.
Do you think there's a military solution to the present crisis? Can Israel accomplish its goals in southern Lebanon, or will it have to be some negotiated solution?
No, there's no military solution to this problem. The Soviets in Afghanistan, all the conventional force that they had, and the Americans in Iraq with all the advanced force Americans have, conventional force cannot defeat a guerrilla movement or terrorist group. And this is going to require a political solution.
And what shape would that solution have, do you think?
I think that Hezbollah is a political a party and a social welfare organization. Obviously, UN Resolution 1559 requires the Hezbollah to give up their militia, which is the best in the business, highly trained, very well equipped, not seen, knows how to operate in all kinds of terrain. And it's not possible for Hezbollah to have a militia within the Lebanese state. So there will need to be a strong international force, NATO or some other combination of forces on the border that can take action, can look for the advanced missiles. And Hezbollah will need to be integrated. The supporters of Hezbollah, the largest single community in Lebanon, will need to be fully integrated into the body politic of Lebanon in order to have a national reconciliation that will allow Lebanon to prosper.
It seems like the Israelis don't want to open up to having an international force in southern Lebanon until they can accomplish most of their military goals. Are they going to have to compromise on that?
I think that they are going to continue to try to have a buffer zone that they will control for a period of time until the international force it becomes available. But clearly, it's a ceasefire is now quite urgent, and it will be very difficult because neither Hezbollah nor the Israelis have an incentive to stop.
And there's been some speculation here in the United States and also in the Israeli press that this is essentially a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran. What do you think of that analysis?
I think it, to some extent that is correct. It is a the U.S., Egypt, Jordan, even Saudi Arabia from the beginning supporting Israel, confronting Hezbollah, which is the surrogate for Iran and Syria. A radical front that has been through violence setting the agenda in the Middle East, which is not acceptable. And I think in that sense, Iran will lose a strategic asset in that its long-range missiles, which are yet to be used, will be removed, and Hezbollah's militia will be diminished. I think that Syria, in fact, has been resuscitated off life support and is now a power player, so that's perhaps a negative in this equation.
And finally, what do you think are the risks of this spreading into being a wider war?
There's always a risk. The emotions are high. There have been a number of accidents. Passions have been aroused. And it is certainly possible that that others might get involved, particularly some of the neighboring countries, Syria. But what's more concerning to me is that if for every action there is a reaction. It doesn't necessarily take place the next day, the next week, but it may take months or even years. And unless this is solved in a way that is going to produce a better situation, I think the aftermath over the next year, two, three, could be full of surprises and dangers.
And that was Judith Kipper, who is a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington, D.C., and one of their principal Middle East experts. And there you have it. The solution to the problems of the Middle East is a independent Palestinian state without any military or security capacity of its own. But that doesn't mean it's going to be a protectorate of Israel. It's just going to be peaceful and maybe a little dependent. All right, let's take a station break, and we'll be back with Jonathan Knutson.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
And this is WBAI, 99.5 FM in your FM on your radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood, program Behind the News. And now we're joined by Jonathan Knutson, who teaches economics at York University in Toronto, and is the author of many books and papers, frequently with his collaborator, Shimshon Bishler. And they have a lot of their material on the web at bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. And I'll say that again at the end of this, but be sure to check it out. Lots of very interesting material there. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Good evening, Doug.
So just to start with, I was reading the Financial Times the other day that Israel will have no problem affording this war. It's no strain at all in its economy. What do you think of that?
Well, the Financial Times takes an aggregate status perspective. So Israel is a sort of a homogeneous entity. It's no longer a homogeneous entity from the perspective of the accumulation of capital. Therefore, it is entirely possible that Most Israelis are going to suffer economically from that war. I don't think that the capitalists that operate in and from Israel will.
Now, is this war is it driven by economics? Do you think, at least from the Israeli point of view?
It's a pretty complicated story, because to understand, I think, the conflict in the Middle East, you can approach it from a sort of a cultural, ethnic, religious perspective, which goes back quite a while. And you can approach it from a question of the processes of capitalism, and the picture that you get is quite different. So there are simmering conflicts all over the region. The question that we find interesting is how these conflicts actually fit into the broader picture of global capital accumulation, and the answers are often quite surprising. I do think that these conflicts have a lot to do with the accumulation of capital. I wouldn't call it economics, because it is a power process as well.
All right, well, let's first focus on the piece of land called Israel, even if it's not the self-contained national entity of elementary textbook economics. Tell us about the organization, the Israeli Economy. What are its principal institutions, its principal sectors, and who owns it?
It's, I think, interesting to know that in the 1990s, the structure of the Israeli political economy has been really transformed fundamentally. Until then, it was a pretty closed political economy with heavy reliance on the military. So, for example, in the 1970s, military spending accounted for a full one-quarter of the gross domestic product of the country. Now they account for about 6%. So there's been a massive move away from so-called war economy. Now, underlying this change, there was, in my opinion, a more fundamental change that concerns the globalization of ownership of the Israeli political economy. And that's not a process that is unique to Israel. It is a process that happened everywhere in the world. But Israel, because it is a small society, has been affected quite dramatically. So what we have now essentially is a capitalist class in Israel that is made of many foreign investors and large transnational corporations that own Israeli assets. For example, Warren Buffett, just a few months ago in May, I think, of 2006, spent about $4 billion to buy a company in Israel that is now under bombardment in the war from the Hezbollah and the war in Lebanon. So a lot of the assets of the Israeli political economy are owned by foreigners. At the same time, you have most of the Israeli owners actually invested elsewhere. So what once was something you can call the Israeli ruling capitalist class is no longer an Israeli capitalist class. Many of them are essentially global investors. So this entity now is very much intertwined with the global processes of accumulation. Now, domestically, it's less reliant on the military compared to what it was in the 70s and in 80s. So I wouldn't argue that this war at all is driven by so-called narrow economic interest in Israel. You cannot understand it independently of the U.S. policy in the Middle East.
And as I recall, the distribution of income in Israel is very, very unequal. It's almost American in its distributional structure, right?
This, again, is part of this process of globalization. So in the 50s, Israel was one of the more egalitarian countries in the world, and now it is, I think the inequality in Israel is probably greater than in the United States, and it's on par with many Latin American countries. So this is, again, part of the consequences of this movement towards globalization. The ruling class is less and less embedded in this country, and therefore it has less and less stake and less and less reason to worry on the social cohesion of that country.
Now, Israel, I think, has a lingering image in a lot of people's minds as the kibbutzes and the kind of socialist or social democratic ethos from its founding. Certainly, a lot of the Zionists came out of it, were also socialists of some sort. That world is long dead, isn't it?
Yes, it started to disintegrate in the 1970s. Many of the kibbutzim, in fact, started to bring in wage labor. They started to invest in the stock market. But most importantly, they were embedded in a country that was moving very rapidly towards towards a form of open liberal or neoliberal capitalism. So they couldn't really exist in that environment, and they have been capitalized and internalized into the system. So the kibbutzim as a political-economic model no longer exists.
Who were the corporate or financial or political elite who were driving this process of global integration and restructuring of the Israeli economy? It's a pretty small group of people, isn't it?
Well, you have anywhere between, domestically, between, I don't know, 10 or 18 families. But again, I wouldn't argue that they actually are driving the process. They have accepted this process in the early 1990s. And essentially, they had to decide whether they are keeping Israel as a closed political economy or they're opening it up. Once they have opened it up, they basically put their assets for sale. And in the proceeds, they have diversified elsewhere. But they haven't been driving the process. They have basically accepted it. And we see similar processes, say, happening in South Korea now. So I wouldn't argue that the Israeli elite, that the economic or the business elite that dominated the country in the 80s actually drove the process. They simply accepted the global process that was taking place.
And when the current defense minister, Amir Peretz, was first taking office, he was cheered as some kind of revival of the old spirit of the organized labor in Israel. He's turned out not to be quite that, right?
It's interesting. Just a day or so ago, there was a piece in the newspaper in which it was indicated that many of the reservists are now very frustrated with the fact that the defense ministry is not allowing them to actually hold on their debt service, etc., while they are on reserve call in the north. And this is from, as they say, a defense minister that is supposed to be socially oriented. So again, once he came into the job, he had to accept the parameters, and the parameters are that Israel has become, you know, a hyper neoliberal society. At the same day that this article was published in the newspaper, the government privatized its oil refineries, sold it for something like $800 million to one of Israel's big capitalists. And he was only too embarrassed. And he said that essentially all of this privatization of strategic assets was unnecessary. And, you know, tongue-in-cheek, he said the next step was to privatize the army, the IDF. So there you have it. You have in the midst of the war, the government chooses to actually privatize strategic assets at the same time that it doesn't take care of its own reservists. It's an indication, I think, of the fractures that tear Israeli society, and you don't hear about it in the foreign press too much.
We also, we certainly know that there's an intimate political relation between the U.S. and Israeli governments. How deeply tied together are the economies of the U.S. and Israel?
They are very tied, and the perhaps the best indication of that tie is if you look at the performance of the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange and compare it to the performance of the NASDAQ. So I'll be a little bit technical, but I'll try to explain myself because it's a pretty staggering picture. If you examine the correlation, which is a statistical measure of a co-movement of the rate of growth of these two stock markets, the ups and downs, in the 1980s, the correlation was negative. In other words, if the NASDAQ would go up, the Israeli market would go down. Nowadays, the correlation is almost perfectly positive. It's almost 100%. It's something like 95%. In other words, 95% of the movements of the Israeli stock market are explained by movements in the NASDAQ. That's an indication of how integrated these two business sectors have become.
And that suggests that the same pools of capital and the same managers of those pools of capital are operating in both places.
Well, you can argue that the principles are identical, and I would accept that, yeah.
I should say I'm speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who is a professor at York University in Toronto and author of many books and papers, many of them in collaboration with Shimshon Bishler, who is based in Israel. And you can read a lot of their stuff on the web at bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. You also have a very interesting theory of the role of oil, oil profits specifically, in explaining when wars in the Middle East happen. So could you lay out that scenario for us?
Well, as you've heard from your previous person on the show, much of the analysis of what happens in the Middle East is happening somewhere at the intersection of the disciplines of international relations, which are relations between countries, and international economics, mostly about resources, especially about oil. So most of the discussion is about state interests. And we have tried to look at some of the other interests that are involved, and we looked specifically at the oil companies. And what we have found was that if you consider the relative performance of the oil companies in comparison to the largest corporations in the United States, so you examine the rate of return of the oil companies and you contrast that rate of return with the same numbers for the leading companies in the U.S. It turns out that every time that the oil companies actually trail the average, in other words, the rate of return is below the leading company averages, there follows a war in the Middle East. And after the war in the Middle East, the performance of the oil companies actually shoots up. And this type of relationship has worked without fail since the end of the 1960s, including the last two Gulf Wars, the Gulf War of 1991 and the present conflict. So these numbers are quite remarkable in their systematic pattern. And, of course, you can dispense with that as being just a sort of a freak statistics. But the magnitudes involved behind them and the politics that we know about the oil companies in the Middle East suggest that that might be a little bit more than just a freak statistical coincidence.
Well, the profitability of oil companies is very heavily dependent upon the price of oil. So you can almost say that when the price of oil gets too low, it's time for a Middle East war.
Well, that's another interesting feature of the relationship between the Middle East and the profits of the oil companies. Most of the analysis of profitability centers both in conservative economics as well as among Marxist economists, focuses on the level of production. But in the case of oil, production is almost irrelevant. If you examine the history of the oil companies since the 1970s, all the variations in the profits are almost entirely explained by variations in the price of oil. The higher the price of oil, the higher the profits. So in the 1980s, when the price of oil in today's prices was roughly $90 a barrel, the oil companies globally accounted for about 20% of all global profits. Now, this ratio has gone down quite systematically, and at the end of Clinton's presidency, it has reached 3%. Now, since then, we know that the price of oil has gone up largely because of what is happening in the Middle East, and the oil companies have their share now of global profit at around 10%, and it will likely rise to about 15% a year from now based on current prices. Now, just to give you the overall magnitudes involved, over the past six years, the four leading oil companies based in the United States and in Europe have earned the equivalence of $1 trillion in net profit, $1 trillion. So the question one needs to ask is very simple. If the oil companies are benefiting from higher prices, and higher prices are the consequence of the conflict in the Middle East, what interest do they have to actually terminate those conflicts?
And, of course, we can certainly see a deep affinity between the current leadership in Washington and the oil industry. You don't need a PhD in political science to figure that out. Those are a bunch of oil guys running the show. So here are the mechanisms pretty easy to see. But how does this, the influence of the relative profitability of oil companies manifest itself or make itself known in the form of wars in the Middle East? I mean, what's the mechanism that by which the decline in profitability leads to some sort of tension and then an explosion into war?
Well, every conflict is different, and every conflict is, is rooted in its own domestic and local circumstances. Without getting into the sort of institutional and historical details of every conflict, you can at the minimum say that every one of the significant wars that happened in the Middle East and that are related to oil, we call them energy conflicts, have taken place with the support, either active or passive, of the U.S. government at the time. And every one of those conflicts essentially could have been prevented or minimized had the U.S. administration wanted to. So the question that you probably want to ask yourself are, what are the specific mechanisms that connect the oil companies and the particular administration in office? Just in the last conflict, just before the conflict, we published a paper in which we said we don't have any concrete evidence on what happened behind the scenes, something like the Pentagon Papers that came out in the 70s, and maybe it will take another 20 years before we have the Exxon Papers out that will tell us what happened in this particular conflict. Well, as it turned out, Greg Palast, the journalist, has just published recently a few pieces in which he claimed to have uncovered documents that suggested there were actually two coalitions in Washington. One coalition was made of the neoconservatives and the Pentagon that wanted to go in into Iraq, essentially immediately privatize Iraqi oil, flood the market and lower the price, and basically undermine OPEC. The other coalition that was made of the oil companies and elements within the Foreign Office essentially would have none of this sort of ideas, and they basically let the neocons carry out the operation, take over Iraq, and when this was completed, they put their own people there. And as we know, there has been no privatization of oil in Iraq. Iraqi oil production has basically deteriorated to almost nothing. And the United States now is a de facto member of OPEC because it rules Iraq, which is a member of OPEC. So this is an example of how this mechanism would work. Every situation is different. For me, the interesting set of facts are actually the statistical facts. The interest that the oil companies have in actually seeing conflict in the region. In fact, conflict in the region benefited not just the oil companies. It benefited the large companies in the world as well through the consequent inflation that has taken place.
Well, some people don't like it when some business sectors don't like it when oil prices are high. Certainly the airline industry is on the verge of death because of it. The auto industry doesn't like it. A lot of financial interests don't like it. Certainly bondholders don't like when inflation rises. So why don't the other sectors of capital gang up on the oil guys and send oil prices back down to $20?
Well, I actually disagree with this type of description. It depends on the circumstances, because at the turn of the 21st century, the big fear was actually deflation. The big fear was that prices are rising at about 1% a year, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Greenspan, was talking about an unwelcome fall in inflation, and he was pretty much encouraged by bond investors of all to actually go for higher inflation. This was a big piece in the Financial Times at the time. This is 2003. So there was a big fear that inflation actually is too low and can turn into deflation with all the risks of debt deflation and falling profit, and et cetera. Now, what we see since the beginning of the hostilities in the region in 2002, 2003, we've seen a rise in inflation as a consequence, partly of the rising price of oil. And if you look at the performance of the corporate sector, the leading corporate sector, the Standard & Poor's 500, compared to wages, it's quite spectacular. Wages haven't moved, but profits have risen, and the correlation with the rate of inflation is almost perfect. In fact, the ratio of profits of the S&P 500 to the hourly wage rate has risen by 250% since the beginning of 2002. And I'm not saying it's entirely because of inflation, but it is very, very tightly correlated with inflation. There's no wonder, because if wages are not rising and you have a 4% inflation, most of it goes to profit. And since profit is a smaller proportion than wages, then the increase in profit is tremendous. So the other companies that are not involved in oil are not necessarily losers in that process. They actually ride on this rise in inflation, and they actually pocket all the benefits. And I think this is quite a significant reason why you hear nothing major in terms of opposition from other sectors in U.S. business to this war that supposedly is going to raise budget deficits and is raising the cost of raw materials and so on, because they're actually benefiting from it quite big time.
All right, thank you. I'm not sure I agree with you, but we're out of time, so we can't continue this conversation. We've been speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who teaches economics at York University in Toronto, and he and his frequent co-author, Shimshon Bishler, have a web archive where you can read a lot of their papers, bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, hopefully with Rasha Salty, who is based in Beirut and has been sending out amazingly moving and intelligent reports from the city under siege. And I should be able to, hoping to get an interview with her next week, which will run on the show next week if all goes well. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening. And let's go out with a little bit more of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 2. This is the first fugue.